Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest today in the studio, Norbert Krupf. Did I say that okay?
Perfect.
Krupf. He'll say it.
Krupf.
And you'll hear it. But he's a Pulitzer Prize nominee and winner of the Lucille Medwick Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America. He's a former poet laureate with the state of Indiana. Those were the years 2008 to 2010, and he's now emeritus professor of English at the CW Post campus of Long Island University, where he taught from just a few years, 1970 to 2004. A couple of things we're going to talk about a little bit later that I was really intrigued with is that while he was the poet laureate, one of the things he focused on was to continue his efforts to reunite poetry and music. And he also really emphasized the collaborations between poets and artists. Norbert grew up in a German community in Jasper, Indiana, which you'll be able to tell had a tremendous effect on his writings and poetries. And he has a soon-to-be-released writing, Catholic Boy Blue, and that's a poet's journal of healing. And it looks at the effects of abuse on a child at the hands of a priest. And we're going to discuss that also later in the show. And what I do want to say is, quoting John Grappi, who was with the Sycamore Review, what he stated about Norbert was that he writes about the spiritual interaction between a people and their place. And I just thought that was a nice way that
yes,
he summed
that
up.
Yes, I was very moved when I read that for the first time.
So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I've been in Lafayette before because I'm married to a Cajun woman
there,
from here.
And that's the connection, folks.
Yeah. Right, that is.
You have been coming here now for, quite a few years. The two of you have been together for quite a while.
43 years of marriage, almost 44, yes.
Yeah. And during that whole time, my guess is you have made trips to this area.
Yes, there was a period of time of almost 20 years after Catherine's mother died when we didn't come back much and we had children and it was a little more complicated. And
there's
on.
A lot going on in life when
yes,
you have kids.
And a lot going on in life. And we lived in Europe for three different years, separated by 7 years each time.
Okay.
So some pretty good, interesting experience that feeds into poetry. Anything can do that, but 2 years in Germany allowed me to do a lot of ancestral research, and I was editing pioneer German journals and letters from the area where I grew up. And that became poems, too, some of that material.
You know, and as we get into talking about some of your history, I'm going to quote, and this was a comment that you had made, my passion for origins has been inseparable from my compulsion to write poems. I find it impossible to live fully in the present without understanding where I have lived in the past.
Yeah, a collective sense of identity and of heritage that is alive within us, and we carry the people who made us possible. In a way, we carry their spirits in us, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's all related to place, too.
How would you describe the area you grew up in?
It's actually very much like the area in which my ancestors lived in Germany in terms of topography. And we find that American immigrants do that.
Yeah.
They need to leave for various reasons. It isn't just that they hate where they were. The conditions were bad and drove
them
out. But there's something in them that helps them find a place that reminds them of where they lived before and where their connections have been for generations.
Yeah.
And that's there's something very – it's not only Native American, but that's deep within the Native Americans. And I've been very influenced by Native American thought, attitudes, conviction, spirituality.
Yeah. When you were young and growing up and maybe in your high school years, was writing present for you?
Not so much writing as reading. Okay. I was an avid reader, and I would go to the library and devour books, bring them home and read. Yeah, I love to read. I don't remember writing very much, but I always enjoyed the writing that I did. I never thought I would become a writer, and I was going to become an engineer, I thought, until my senior year of high school when I had a great English teacher named Jack London Leese, and he was my inspiration to become an English major and then an English teacher, and I thought I was going to teach in high school, and he convinced me to take Latin as a second subject because this is ironic, he said, if you get certified in Latin, you'll never have to look for a job. We know what happened to Latin.
Yeah, that's right. I'm curious. You said his middle name was London?
Yeah.
Jack London?
Yeah. His dad was a high school principal or superintendent, and that's after Jack London.
Yeah, but, you know, was that planned?
Pardon me?
You know, I mean, that his parents put that out there for his – You know, Jack London from our...
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah. We called him Jack the Ripper. It was a nickname we gave him. But he was a great man, and he was a huge influence. He became a friend after I graduated from high school, and then a friend of the family. So that all the years that I was away from Jasper from 1961 when I graduated high school until he died in 2000, I always went to see him when we came home.
Yeah.
And I flew back home for his funeral to be his pallbearer.
Mm.
So that's the kind of thing that can happen in a small town.
That's right. That's right. Then the reading and subsequently the writing of poetry, when did that come?
Well, the writing didn't come until I'd given up on it coming.
Yeah.
I thought that it wasn't going to happen. And then we got married at Notre Dame. We met at the University of Notre Dame.
It's a beautiful campus.
And we moved to the – I had told an English major friend in college at St. Joseph's College in northern Indiana. I said, you know, I'd bet if I moved east, I'd start writing. In other words, I'd have something worthwhile to write about. Mm-hmm. How can you write about the Midwest?
Wow.
Everybody knows that's not sophisticated. There's not a literary tradition. And I was right, but for the wrong reasons. What did I write about is my Midwestern childhood and origins,
right.
Family history, and all that sort of thing, yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I am
that's origins,
I'm
too.
A Midwesterner.
Yes.
And when somebody says those things, I right away get very defensive of are you kidding me? Come on, let's talk about what what all comes out of that area. Of
yeah,
the United
I mean,
States.
I say now that any place can take us into the depths of human life and history and culture if we know how to do it right and explore it. You're not there for the Chamber of Commerce, although they might like what you're doing.
Sure.
But you're there to go down and mine it for all its human richness, and that can be light and it can be darkness, you know, and there can be racism here or there or anywhere. That poem about that I won the Lucille Medwick Memorial Award was about a racial incident in my freshman year of college at St. Joseph's College. A black friend I made, it was really the first black person I ever knew.
Sure.
And there was an incident in which there was a basketball game with our Lutheran arch rivals, a very close game, fiercely contested, and at the end we lost. And everybody, it's all male environment, everybody was worked up. And they came back to the dorm, and Leland was in his room, and he hadn't gone to the game. And they saw him as a traitor, and somebody squirted lighter fluid under the door. You know, and I was there paralyzed, and I didn't say or do anything, but I thought it was horrible. 30 years later, well, I get a list of my classmates, and I looked for his name, and it said, Leland Richards, deceased. Hmm. And that poem, that whole thing that I had not been thinking about came right back up, and it became this poem that, after being rejected by about 20 or 25 magazines, won a prize from the Poetry Society of America.
Do you have that here?
Yeah, it's in Bloodroot, yeah.
Do you think
it's called Fire and Ice?
Could we?
Yes.
I read Fire and Ice.
Did you? Yes.
Okay.
I'd be glad to read that.
That would
if
be
I can
fantastic.
Find the page where it's on. Let's see. It's in this book. Yeah, page 90. So you want me to read that?
That would be fantastic.
Okay. Fire and Ice. As you know from looking at my work, I write often a narrative poem. I love to tell stories. Fire and ice, dead of winter, snow, ice, winds lashing the plains of frozen northern Indiana. The brick field house of the Catholic college that admitted only men roared like an overheated furnace. Poles, Irish, and Italians from the cities around the Great Lakes a few Germans from the hills to the south along the Ohio. We stretched our vocal cords to the snapping point as our team scratched, slipped, rallied, and finally failed against Lutheran arch rivals. When we entered the igloo of our freshman dorm, someone incensed found rays of light escaping into the hall from beneath Leland Richards' door. Leland was a black intellectual from Cleveland who had dared to stay home and not support the holy communal cause. Maybe he was reading a book, writing a letter to his family, or just wanted to be alone. Maybe he was thinking about what to do with his life. Someone knocked on the door. No answer. Someone pounded. Still no answer. Stayed in his room during the game, echoed down the hall. Someone brought a can of lighter fluid and squirted it under the door. Someone else struck and flipped a match. Flame zigzagged under the door that bitterly cold night as someone chanted, "Spear Chucker!" I stood there watching, listening from a distance, while my friend sat alone, trapped between fire and ice. I could not find whatever words should have come out. Leland never once mentioned that night, when we later sat in the cafeteria discussing literature and foreign films. I could never bring myself to ask how it felt to watch flame shoot beneath his door, hear the chant from beyond. Two springs later, after green flames lit brown grass around the pond in front of the chapel with the postcard twin towers, Leland entered a seminary. I never heard from him again. I have just learned he is dead. So 30 years that was earlier that that happened. It's amazing what stays inside us, waiting to be called up if we only know how to turn and tap it.
That's right. I'm curious, Norbert, what did that poem bring to your life, or possibly what did you learn from that whole part of your life, that process of writing that piece?
Well, it was a complex of things, and there's a kind of moral that I always express to my audiences that I did send it out 20 or 25 times to magazine editors, and it always came back with a rejection form. But I believed in the poem. I could see from time to time that I could make it better, and I kept doing that. And so it won this award, and I sent the poem to some writer friends and people who were friends of my poetry, saying this poem won a prize and so on. And some of the poets said, "Oh, that's a good poem. You really ought to send that out and get it published." And I sent it to five more magazines, and they all rejected it. I knew it was a very good poem because it was too honest in a way.
That's right.
For people to face it. And there's some of that in Catholic Boy Blues also. Yeah. So in a way, I learned that I could face and confront dark subjects. And I could talk about my own complicity, maybe even if it's only implied or silent, you know.
Yeah.
And, if I had condemned everybody else, the poem, and acted superior to them, I think the poem would have a different effect on people.
Yeah.
You know, but when you somehow or other come to understand that you are a part of it, maybe not as much as everybody else, but still somehow, I think people listen better
to what
you're saying.
And you know what? As time, you know, in life goes by, we all learn and understand different ways of taking in.
I wasn't able to write it before
probably.
You know? And just as I wasn't able to write these poems about childhood abuse for 50 years.
Yeah.
The first line in the book in my preface is, "For 50 years, I did not want to write these poems." And that's the God's truth.
Yeah. Even though you could feel them
coming. Yes. Well, I guess in a way, the writing of that childhood memoir was a prelude to it and a prerequisite. And there's a chapter in that book which Catherine saw was a metaphor for the childhood abuse, which she knew about in general but knew no details of. And she said when she read that chapter, she writes everything that comes off the piece of yellow legal paper.
Yeah, that's how you write.
Yeah, I write on pads. Love to do it. And I don't type poems in the keyboard. I do that book I did by typing it into the keyboard, that prose book. But poetry, I need to feel it going across the page somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
But she said, "Boy, you really gave it to him, huh?" My father and I took this priest hunting as part of our we had a ritual of going hunting at my dad's aunt's farm near the village where he grew up every Labor Day weekend, and we invited the parish priest to come along. And he didn't function very well, and he wasn't a good mentor. You know, that's what I said. But there was more going on than I realized in telling that story. It was because of that chapter that these poems eventually came. It was like a opening of a door down into the subconscious.
That was part of that whole process for you.
The almost total recall from 50 years before was just absolutely stunning. I mean, Catherine is the one who can talk about what it was like having me around the house writing poems night and day, almost indiscriminately.
Yeah.
Just wandering around for weeks, you know, like that.
Which was different than how your process has worked before in terms of some of these
not
other books.
Completely. It was different in that it was maybe more intense and more poems coming quicker. But I tend to write poems in groups and clusters. One comes and then another one comes and then it becomes something larger. So in that sense, it's similar. But the subject matter is rather different.
Right.
But I have a book of a group of poems about the Holocaust and Blue-Eyed Grass, which is relevant to what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The racial incident with Leland Richard and then the childhood abuse. But the Holocaust, it's all a part of confronting the darkness, very difficult material.
Can we talk about this book for a little
bit? Blue-Eyed Grass, sure.
If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange, and my guest today, Norbert Krof, is a poet and writer from Indiana. He is a former poet laureate for the state of Indiana. We have the pleasure of having him here because his wife, Catherine, is a native of Lafayette. And thank you to Daryl Bork, our own former poet laureate, who made the connection that you were going to be here visiting.
I love Daryl's work.
Yeah. Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah. We'd be fools not to, wouldn't
that's
we?
That's right. Now, this book, Blue-Eyed Grass, it brings in, you know, you talked a lot about your family history and looking at that German ancestry. Can you tell us about how this book came to be?
Well, in a sense, it started to come into being when we moved away from Indiana to the East Coast, and that's when I started to write poetry. And I started to study German seriously for the first time. It wasn't taught between...
To study the language or the history?
The language.
The language, okay.
And then the history and family history, but started to study the language. It wasn't taught in Jasper, my German Catholic hometown, between 1917, when it and other languages were outlawed during World War II.
Sure.
And, I mean, World War I, and... 1972, by which time I had been gone 11 years from town. So I heard German spoken in the house and in family reunions, you know, and by members of the older generation. And it was a mix of 19th century German and some Southern Indiana English, but that stayed with me. And I took one semester of German in college as an overload. Because I had this minor in education and a minor in Latin and a major in English. And there's just I was taking 19, 20, 21 hour credits.
That's right.
So it was crazy.
Yeah.
I started to study German in adult ed classes in Long Island, high school adult ed classes. I started to research family history to find out where we had come from in Germany. And what I discovered was that my mom and dad's families lived no more than 20 miles apart in Germany, but nobody knew that anymore.
Mm, yeah.
And Franconia in northern Bavaria. And then, so it was the language, German language. It was starting to write poetry, and it was family history, all of those things together. And I'm still doing them all now.
Yeah.
Not as much family history as before, but that sort of deepens, and that led me into discovering that there was a German Jewish woman named Clara Kropf who lived just a few miles from my ancestors who died in Theresienstadt in World War II. And that became a kind of project. We were living in Germany in 88, 89, and 88 was the 50th anniversary of the Kristallnacht in Germany, the beginning of the onslaught against the Jews. There were exhibits and museums in the town museum of Erlangen near Nuremberg, where we lived, in the wonderful German National Museum in nearby Nuremberg. And we went to that in January of 89. And at the end of the exhibit, it was historical, and it wasn't just about World War II and the Holocaust, but it ended there. And there was the replica of either a train station or maybe a barracks in a camp with the – and this is early for computers, you know, and PCs, mm-hmm. but the names of all of the Jews of Bavaria who were deported to camps and killed were on the wall. And so even though I knew we were Catholic going all the way back as far as I knew, I searched the places where I knew my family had come from, and there were no crops until I got to a little village called Wohnfurt near one of our villages. And there was the name of Clara Kropf. And I thought, what does this mean?
Yeah.
Does that mean that somehow or other we were part Jewish or what? And I started to try to find out everything I could. And I contacted a man who had done research on the Jews of Lower Franconia. And he was fascinated by my project. He's Christian. He's Catholic. But he put me in touch with other people, all Catholic, who did research on the Jews of Franconia, and they we found out more. I knew what town she was in from the records on the wall there, and we came back. We met him, and he said, "I'm going to help you. I believe in what you're doing." We got back to the United States, and I read everything I could find on Theresienstadt. We came back in 89. In 92, we came over as a family to revisit where we lived, visit friends, mm-hmm. and saw Roland. And we went on the trail of Clara Kropf. By that time, we knew where she was deported from, what train station. We went all the way to Theresienstadt in the Czech Republic, where she died, and so on. And when we got back, I wrote a cycle of poems about her. And it was a very powerful experience. But I never expected when I started to trace family history that I was... Wait a minute, my wife has something
to say.
No, go
ahead, Catherine.
Deborah?
Pardon?
Deborah.
Oh, where this led was I hoped that these poems would reach the Jewish crops because there were Christian crops and Jewish crops.
Yeah.
And this is true for all the names in Germany. I wasn't so aware of that then. And there was a wonderful piece in the New York Times, the Long Island section, about this book. And it was written by a former student of mine, Avital Loria Hahn from Israel. She told me it was the most popular piece she ever wrote, that people stopped her on the streets to compliment her about it. I thought for sure, since those Clara Kropf had five siblings, all of whom came to the United States, but she stayed apparently to help take care of her elderly parents eventually,
sure.
And that's how she came to die, really. But I thought that the New York Times had that article and the Jewish Weekly had another article on it. I thought for sure this would put me in touch with them. Nothing happened. 5 years later, one day, I got an email at the end of a semester from a Kropf, someone who was a Kropf relative. And I get all kinds of letters from people who were Kropfs because they know I've done so much genealogy. And I said to Catherine, I'm not opening this email until I finish all my papers and turn in all my grades. It was December.
Yeah, yeah.
And I finished it, and I opened it up, and this woman said, my name is Deborah Koshlin, but I'm a Kropf. And we had an ancestor named Clara we think might have died in the Holocaust. Could that be your Clara? It was.
Wow.
It was amazing. She's become a good friend. She's from Seattle. We visited her in Seattle. We met her first time when she came to New York, and we spent a day going around to museums and so on. So you never know where this is going to take you, you know?
Yeah, and what a great way to fill in those missing pieces,
oh, yes.
You know?
Fabulous.
Is there a piece that you can read from?
Letter to
her relatives?
Yes.
Yeah, it's in this book. It's called, let's see, Letter to the Brothers and Sisters of Clara Kropp from Bonfort.
Bonfort
is her
was,
town.
Okay.
And we walk the streets, and there's a tiny little Jewish ghetto. It's almost like one street, isn't it? Let's see.
Were you able to see a place where she had lived, or was that?
Yes,
long?
The house is there, and
oh,
it's the
it
town
is.
Post office. Part of it is the town post office. And we knew that her people were, in German, Kleintierhändler. They raised and sold small animals like chicken, pigs, goats, whatever. And there was a building out there, which is where they did that. You could see it. It was still there, yeah. But they had been long gone at that time. Let's see. 101, okay. I a lot of my poems are letters to people of the past, in a sense. I was a great letter writer, and I don't write emails. I write letters still, but
still
I send them out electronically.
Oh, okay.
Okay, to the brothers and sisters of Clara Kropp from Bonfort, dear Jewish Kropps, who had the good sense and good fortune to resettle somewhere in America 2 wars before it became a death sentence to stay in this village in the land of your birth, dear Filipina and Teresa, they have turned the front of your farmhouse in the village post office. Dear Nathan, dear Maximilian and Siegfried, born in the 1870s when Bismarck and Deutschland were at war with Frankreich and your father Wolf wanted the names of his sons to sound as German as possible. Dear sons and daughters but one of Babette Rheinstein of nearby Gochsheim, they have changed the name of the village ghetto from Judenhof, Jewish quarters, to Fuchshof, after the nobleman who financed its construction in the 1600s and eliminated almost all traces of your life here. Dear brothers and sisters of the Clara Kropp I was destined never to meet, but who haunts my waking and sleeping, there are still pink and red geraniums in the window boxes on the houses along the Hauptstrasse where you once walked. The street still bends at the point where the Catholic Church commands a view of the farmhouse behind which your father bred and sold enough animals to support a family. Bonfort is still a one-street village except for the Gasse that was the ghetto off to the side. It's almost like an alley.
Yeah.
Dear Jewish Kropps who resettled somewhere in my native country, you must have learned what happened to the sister who stayed behind with Babette and Wolf. Never married, spent a dozen years in the Jewish nursing home in Würzburg before being finally resettled in another kind of home in spa country in Bohemia. That's very ironic, of course. Dear Filipina and Teresa, dear Nathan and Maximilian, dear Siegfried, please excuse my indulgence in sending a letter from a farmhouse in Franconia to people I never met, whose address I do not know, whose life on earth must have ended about half a century ago. Dear reader, if you know any of the descendants of the brothers and sisters of Clara Kropp of Bonfort, whose life was made to come to the wrong conclusion in Theresienstadt, please have them get in touch. I have 100 questions to ask. And it happened, you know? I got that email.
You got that email.
An email 5 years later. And it just took off from there.
That was a piece from Blue Eyed Grass, Poems of Germany by Norbert Kropp. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana Lafayette and right here at Cypress Lake Studios. Please check out the website at krvs.org. And thanks to everybody who continues to help support this station, because we are listener supported and a great a secure way to continue to help us out, you just go on the website, click the donate button, and it's as easy as that. If you're just joining us, my guest today, Norbert Croft, poet and writer who hails from Jasper, Indiana.
That's right.
A former poet laureate for the state of Indiana, and we are blessed to have him here in our area in a roundabout way due to his wife, who is a native of Lafayette.
Cooks a great gumbo, by the way.
And cooks a great gumbo. And Daryl Bork. I always threw in a plug for him. Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, the other line that really stuck out for me in that poem was where you really address the members of the family who left that area that in the long run allowed that book to be written, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that really understood that for whatever reason it was time for them to leave.
Yeah, and after Deborah got in touch with me, I met other of her relatives, some of whom had sort of not been so close anymore. And the beautiful irony from my point of view is that my poems about Clara helped to bring them back together.
Oh, isn't that fabulous?
And there were there was an archivist in the, I think it was in Bonefort, wasn't it? I gave a reading from this book when it came out in 1997 in Würzburg, which is the regional capital. It was the ecclesiastical capital also. And this man, who was an archivist, came up. I read these poems.
In German
or English?
They were in
German and English.
Oh, you did in both. Okay.
I read the English. No, I read them. Did I read them in? My introduction had to be in German.
Yes.
I worked for something like 55 hours to complete because I don't write German very well.
Yeah.
At the end of that reading, there was a German translator who read the translations of my poems into German about Clara. And at the end, a man named Schindler, like as in Schindler's List,
sure.
I don't think he was related, came up and he said, I have a picture for you. It was Clara Kropf.
Oh, my goodness.
From her Ausweis, her identity card as a Jew during the Nazi period.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Oh, my goodness.
So this is what the poems did.
Yeah.
And then her relatives had never seen it. Her living relatives had never seen a picture of her. So I was able to give them a picture. And that man had sent me a lot of information on the archives that they never had. And I gave them that material.
Wow.
So there you are. That's what poetry can do. W.H. Auden says poetry makes nothing happen. He's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't change the world overnight. But I like what Gary Snyder, the so-called beat poet, said. If we move the world a millionth of an inch, we're really doing something important.
That's right.
So I just think of a millionth of an inch.
And that was a lot more than a millionth of an
inch. That was 2 millionths of an inch.
I think I'd
maybe three, you know.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's fascinating. You know, you're going to have to come back because, I mean, we've got some time.
I hereby accept.
But everything that we want to talk about, we're not going to get in. Yeah. I want to go back for a minute to your book, Bloodroot.
Mm-hmm.
That was a book, and for people that are listening that live in this area and also grew up in rural areas, there are a number of pieces in here that and there's some wonderful pictures. And I have say, by the way, your books all have incredible covers.
Yeah, they are beautiful.
I mean, they really are.
Yeah.
But this one really, I think back to the quote that the gentleman said about you, where you really connect that human spirit to nature.
Place. Yeah.
This book really does that.
This is a selection of 175 poems written over a 35-year period from five different already published books, selections, but also 40 new poems. And it's one of three books I have published with Indiana University Press in their series called Quarry books, which is all about Indiana and regional history.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And they're all illustrated books. To be in that series and to become trade editions, they had to be illustrated with photographs. So they're photographs by three different Indiana photographers. So those are collaborative books also.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to say for folks that want to find out more about Norbert and his work, you can go to Kruff, and that's K-R-A-P-F, poetry. .com and that will lead you to some of the things we're talking about. But you know, you have poems that relate to a lot of daily life traditions that occur, and especially occur in rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really noticed too some of the photographs you had with the hogs and with the pigs and what that whole process was about.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting here, and Lucius Fontenot, if you're listening, you need to see this book because there's also a younger generation that is really paying attention to those traditions in this area.
And a resurgence.
They are. And they're teaching about, you know, that it wasn't just about, you know, a party atmosphere to have a boucherie, but what that really was about in that day-to-day life, and you really capture it in this book.
You're probably thinking of the poem Butchering, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's just such I think every piece that people think about in terms of what is going on around us in the earth, you've captured a
skinning
lot.
Skinning a rabbit, I just
saw. Skinny, yeah, skinning.
I did a lot of hunting, and I trapped rabbits as a kid in grade school.
And that's where that came from.
And I went out every morning before school, before grade school, and checked my traps.
Yeah.
You know, with a burlap bag to put the rabbit in if I caught one. Yeah.
Would you read something else from this book?
Sure. Would you like me to read Butchering?
Yes.
Would that be appropriate?
Yeah, because I think that's really interesting.
Now, I wrote this poem when we lived in England, and my mom and dad and my sister came over for Christmas in 1973, and I had the photograph that this is inspired by in a folder, and I asked my mother for details. I had only been to one boucherie, as I remember as a kid, because we moved into the city of Jasper, which was 7,000, and we were the city slickers to my relatives still on the farm. They teased us about being the city slickers.
Was that a term used there, boucherie?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No. Just butchering, wasn't
it? Yeah, butchering, yeah.
But anyway, so I'm in England in Christmas. My mom and dad and my sister come over, and I talk to my mother about family history, and we look at this photograph, and I write my notes on the side of the picture. And later on, I write this poem because the details, a lot of them came from my mother, and that's true of many of the poems, especially my earliest book.
Yeah.
Butchering after a family photograph in memory of my grandmother, Mary Hoffman Schmidt, 1883 to 1977. In front of the weathered smokehouse, the scaled hogs hang, hind feet tied to an ash sapling wedged between forks in the framing maples. The squeals of animals dying have long since frozen into silence. Snouts have dripped circles of blood onto a sheet of January snow. In a field behind the smokehouse, out of range of the camera eye, the women empty intestines thin as onion skin for casings while other innards boil in iron pots. Carving at a carcass in the middle of the picture, the men half turn and frown as if to say, "We kill to survive. Starvation lurks just down the road. We have no time for your art or your sentimentality." The man in overalls and boots who squints the hardest is my grandfather, 33. 3 years later, on doctor's advice, he took a walk. 0 degree breezes fanned the flames of consumption hidden in his chest. 2 weeks later, he lay in cold earth. So, in a way, that's a collaborative poem. Here it is. I have a picture from family history, which we got. Catherine and I would go home to Jasper and go around talking to the oldest living relatives in the pre-computer days, you know. And we would take notes, and then we're in England, and my mother comes over, and I show her this in our scrapbook, and she gives me details, and I write them down, and after she leaves, I write this poem.
Wow.
So it comes out of searching. It comes out of exploring. It comes out of looking for identity, a lot of this stuff.
I am going to be selfish here for
okay.
a minute because I would like you to read a poem.
Well, you ought to get at least one, I think.
And it's from this book, and it's called Indigo Bunting.
Oh, yes. That's one of my
and
favorites.
It's one of my favorite birds.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And I thought, boy, wouldn't that be fabulous if I could hear you read
yeah.
this poem. But it's a great one. It's on page 10.
10, okay.
Yeah. And this is for... You know, all those birders that are out
okay.
there. But I just thought it would be nice to hear your voice put to this.
The poem Fire and Ice is on my CD that I did with Indiana University German-born jazz pianist composer Monica Herzig. And we paired it. This was my suggestion. I'm very proud of it. The Billie Holiday song, Strange Fruit, about a lynching. And it worked. The first time we did it without any rehearsal, it was a killer, and we knew it.
Yeah, yeah.
We recorded this, but, you know, I don't remember if this got on the CD. It's too bad it didn't, yeah. Anyway, Indigo Bunting. Back when I was as convinced as only a young skeptic can be, that I would never meet anyone to fall in love with, would never wake up between warm sheets, breathing in unison with the right woman, would certainly never marry. Couldn't conceivably know the pleasure of looking deep into the eyes of a son or daughter. I was walking alone along a winding rock road in my beloved hills of southern Indiana. I was kicking rocks with my right foot into dry Queen Anne's lace in the hot August sun. A faint whir skimmed across those flat tops of snowy white. I looked up just in time to see a streak of blue so pure and sweet I thought I had never looked up at the sky. For the first time, my friend, I was ashamed of my certainty. This blue is for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, and such a great gift, you know, I mean, this like great, I took it as this great kind of love story. And
it
this
is.
Beautiful
it's a
gift.
Love song, yeah.
And, you know, any time that I have been around people who have seen any type of bunting,
mm-hmm.
it's quite an experience, you know, when because they're beautiful, beautiful
what's
birds.
What's that bird that we see? Is it colored bunting? Or what's
painted
it?
Bunting.
Painted bunting.
Yeah.
My God, they're in Florida. They're at my sister's house.
We get
house.
Them here. Through. They come
oh,
through
my.
At certain times of
yeah.
the April, actually. We get a lot of buntings
out. They are beautiful.
Yeah. So thank you very much.
That I just want to point out that we adopted as infants two children from Bogota, Colombia. So that sort of figures in there. Could conceivably know the pleasure of looking deep into the eyes of a son or daughter. So there's stuff behind poems that, you know,
that's
is interesting
right.
for an audience to find out about sometimes.
Wonderful.
The backstory, as we like to say today.
And if you just joined us, this is The Exchange on KRVS. My guest today, poet and writer Norbert Croft, who's treating us to just some incredible poems and stories. I do want to talk about the newest piece that you're going to have coming out, and that's the Catholic Boy Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where we want to start with that, and I guess how that came about. The book itself, this is about healing, and it is a book of poetry, and I believe that it's such a wonderful way for people to address a subject. This is about abuse that happened with yourself and has happened with
sixth
many folks. Sixth through eighth grade.
Yeah.
And
in the 1950s, the latter part of the 1950s,
okay.
yeah.
And involved a Catholic priest.
Yes.
Which is a pretty hot topic these
you
days.
You betcha.
You know, I mean, for people, you know, really feeling more comfortable talking about mm-hmm. that issue.
It's a topic that's not going away because there was so much of it, and there's so much uncovered still.
Yeah. And, you know, you started speaking about this earlier, about how that process started happening for you and that these poems, I mean, it just wouldn't stop.
Yeah. Once you get started, it doesn't stop, and you don't know where it's going to go, and you don't know, in a way, what material you might become equipped to treat that you couldn't treat before, because sure. every time you move into something somewhat new, it makes something else possible even before you realize that that is happening.
Yeah.
That's what I can see now looking back after having been writing and publishing for 43 years. It helps to see that, you know.
This piece took how long for you to put together?
Well, it took me 50 years to become able to want to write about it and admit that I should.
Yeah.
And then in 2007, this is going to sound unbelievable, but it was 325 or 30 poems came. And I wrote other poems in that same year. I should say drafted them, you know, because they weren't all finished. Some of them more so than others. And I had to get away from those poems.
From the poems that deal with this subject matter or the other poems?
Oh, just this, 325 of them.
I just can't imagine.
That's why I said it was night and day. We were talking earlier before we went on air. Yeah. And I would return at the end of each of those years to look at the poems to try. There was the Poetry Society of America, which had given me an award earlier for a poetry competition, a poem on a humanitarian theme, that was Fire and Ice. They have a prize for a book of poems in progress or a book of verse, verse drama. And I came to see that this could be both.
Yeah.
Because the poems came without any premeditation on my part in four voices.
Yeah.
First, the boy that I was, the victim who's still inside of me now, the man I became. And then my favorite is Mr. Blues, who is based on so many of the great blues singers that I've been listening to for 50 years, just about now, close to it. And he is a kind of mentor, kindly, grandfatherly, earthy figure, sense of humor, and a little bit like a Greek chorus commenting on the action and what the others say. And they're all me.
But he's the one that really allows this process to happen.
I think
to get to that point.
He's the healing agent in the book, as far as I'm concerned.
And, I think,
and the blues are the healing agent too.
Yeah.
And I got into therapy after I had written the first 250 poems.
Wow.
And the therapist had to catch up with all those poems. You know, we discussed them and so on. And one day she said to me, "Now, Norbert, you let those poems come, right?" I said, "Yep." She said, "Well, I have a suggestion. Now, you don't have to accept it, but," she said, "would you maybe consider writing poems in the voice of the priest?" And I said, I started twisting in my chair. And, "I don't know if I want to go. I don't know." She said, "Well, okay, don't worry about it. But would you, if they wanted to come, would you let them come?" I said, "Well, I guess I'd have to." So I went home and I thought about it for 2 days and I said, "I know that voice. I know how he thought. I knew his rationalizations. I knew his anger. I knew his, you know, the way he covered it up and was expressed anger." And I said, "Yes, like I'm going to try that." And so more poems started coming. And he couldn't, like I think almost every abuser, he couldn't admit to what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And he rationalized, and then he got angry at the boy. But what fascinated me was every time he did that and wasn't sincere or covered something up, the boy spoke out again and got angry at him and went right for the jugular vein. You know?
Yeah.
So it was that more of that dialogue and give and take. But it added, I think everybody, I've only given two readings from these poems because I wasn't ready to do it, to go public yet. I gave two readings by invitation only, one last fall in southern Indiana near where the abuse took place, by invitation only. About 32 people at that one in a private home as in a house concert series.
Sure.
The second one in a home in Indianapolis in January, about 25 or 27 people. I call them catacombs readings, going back to the early Christians having to hide out,
That's right.
And a little bit of an irony there. And everybody at those two readings agreed that that last section in the voice of the priest really deepens the book. It makes him more of a human being. Mm-hmm. It's too easy to consider any victimizer and culprit a kind of monster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Without any human dimension
at all.
That all
you see is the villain.
And it's been pointed out by professionals that very often someone who is an abuser was abused him or herself.
Yeah.
Now, I have no evidence of that in the case of this priest because he died 20 years before I started writing the poems. There's only one poem in which I meet him as an adult, and it was at my father's wake. In front of my father's coffin, he came back from the country where he had been reassigned. And I introduced my wife to the priest. That's called At My Father's Wake. That's one of the poems in here.
Is there one that you could read for us today?
There's one that I could read. Some of them I wouldn't read on the air because they're kind of tough and detailed.
Sure.
But this is one I think summarizes. It's the end of the second section. And I wrote 100 poems, and I thought, God, that has to be it. I don't want to write more poems than this. And then they started up again, and I wrote another 100 poems. And this is the last one in the second section, and it's called This Is Not the End. I was hoping it was the end of the book, but I knew it wasn't the end of the process. But it means more than that, too.
And whose voice is this through?
Well, you know,
or is it
sometimes there's just a narrative voice. And this
okay.
is kind of a narrative one, and I would say that it's – probably the man speaking.
Sure.
Yeah. But the boy is always present in the man.
Yeah.
You know. And the man is kind of present in the boy too because he's, you know, what the boy is going to become.
That's right.
This is not the end. Once upon a time there was a priest who took advantage of young boys, deceived their parents, and covered his tracks. But after the boys became men and could no longer keep quiet, some of them told the bishop and insisted that if he did not speak out, this whole sad story would explode and many people would be hurt. The bishop spoke. Other boys who were now fathers and grandfathers gathered the strength to tell their story, but some could still not take the step. One day they may be able to make their move and have their say. You may even know who they are. Nobody in any of these stories, wherever they take place, will live happily ever after. But if people can summon what it takes to tell the truth, they can live together and help others find their voice. One voice singing by itself can sound awfully small. But several voices lifting as one can make a chorus that sings a mighty song. In a way, that's the message of the book, I
suppose. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And you know, too, I think a piece like this book that you have put together, what a great tool to use in therapy sessions.
We hope so.
I mean, seriously. And, you know, it's a great piece, I think, for people to be able to take home and to start to feel and to get in touch with some things that may have occurred in their lives or in the lives of somebody that they know.
There are many people who well, let me put it this way. When we were still living in New York and I would read about the scandals in Boston and Los Angeles and Chicago and Lafayette, Louisiana, the diocese and so on, there would always be remarks that some people were skeptical that the so-called victims were not telling the truth. They were making it up. And that made me very angry because I could tell from everything or anything that they said that it was true.
It's true
because
yeah.
it matched my experience.
That's right.
But we all have to understand that there some people just aren't able to talk about their experience.
Yeah.
Even and it, you might say, "Well, get over it," but the thing is, it affects you in ways that you don't understand, and it affects the way the people that you live with and how you live with them, and their children, and then their grandchildren, and it ramifies and it expands and it ripples, and it's not good for a community, because a community can be ill in ways it doesn't understand and need healing.
That's right, and you know, and I think for any person who has been a victim of whatever the abuse has been.
And it's not limited to the Catholic Church at all.
That reading pieces that people have put together about their experiences gives you that sense of, I'm not crazy. I'm not wrong. I'm not making
I'm not
this
weird.
Up. That's right.
I didn't cause it. It's not my fault.
That's
I've got
right.
one called Symptoms, which is addressed to people who might have the same kind – the symptoms are really signs that you're a survivor of it, and you try to right all wrongs, and you get frustrated when authority figures don't do what they do, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of us. I mean, how many victims are there throughout the world?
That's
I mean,
right.
Hundreds of thousands wouldn't do it justice, I think.
How – when you were at the catacombs, when you're at those two readings, how was it received?
Well, very well. But as I told the second audience, you are a wonderful audience. I know. I cherry-picked each one of you.
No, you okay.
So I had to have that kind of experience first to feel comfortable with the material and know how people would respond. Not every audience is going to be that positive.
That's right.
And I know that there's a tradition of shooting the messenger, and I'm bringing bad news to some people.
Yeah.
It might be news that they are kind of aware of but don't want to hear. You know?
Did you receive helpful feedback from some of those people in terms of how to go about getting this out there?
Well, I mean, by that time it had already been accepted for publication.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't share that with too many people because you don't want to keep talking about everything all the time to everybody, or you just have no life. And
sure.
what can happen, the danger, as a therapist has kept reminding me, is you can be re-abused pretty easily by what people say. And they might not even – and it can even be some supporters who want you to do a certain thing. They feel you have to do this in order to help them in their cause, which is good, but – it might be damaging to you. So you have to learn about boundaries and that sort
That's
of thing.
That's right.
So it's a precarious minefield in a way.
Yeah. And so this – we're talking about Catholic Boy Blues, A Poet's Journal of Healing. That's to come out this April?
April, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's going – the first reading is going to be at Garrison Keillor's Common Good Books in St. Paul, Minnesota. Then the second one will be in Indianapolis at the Interchurch Center, and we are putting together a kind of coalition of faith leaders, including a bishop and an archbishop, and Prevent Childhood Abuse Indiana. And I think that where I can't give as many readings from this book as I do from my other books because the material is so difficult and so explosive, and so can the reactions be. But I want to – I was advised by a woman who's in charge of Prevent Child Abuse Indiana that I could find someone in every state wherever I read. There's a leader, a state leader, who could help get someone, some representative from that organization there to give out materials to help people who need to talk about this and so on. And to detect it. This book should help people detect it also.
That's right.
And, well...
Okay. We are out of time.
Oh.
Norbert, I want to thank you. This is Norbert Kroff. I want to tell people again to go to Kroff, K-R-O-P-F, poetry.com.
K-R-A-P-F.
K-R-A-P-F, poetry.com.
Thank you.
I'm Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 4 p.m. for your weekly serving on KRVS 88.7 FM. Listener-supported public radio for Acadiana.
This week on This American Life, twin 13-year-old girls who do not get along.
I got to see her when I wake up, when I go to sleep, and I don't like her.
By chance, their middle school is run by twin brothers, Ronnie and Reggie Richardson.
They're like, whoa, no, that's totally against twin code. Let's talk about this.
Seeing yourself and others... and where that leads this week.
Thursday night at 7 on KRVS. Regional Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.